Mel nudges the goldfish bowl off the sill and watches it smash 12 floors below. This is an act of mercy. Better the fish die fast in the open air. From one of 100 windows, someone shouts. Laid out below, London glitters like an endless plane of broken glass, ready to cut the unwary to ribbons. She closes her eyes against the unrelenting shimmer and tastes the wind instead. Exhaust fumes, blocked drains, and a smoky deep-fat fryer. Tomorrow is only the 1st of May, but spring is already seeding to summer. The air holds the heat of several sunny days.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my drunken Odysseans, to episode 350 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. Ah, my voice is almost all the way back to healthy. So, 350, that's at least 350 hours that I have been talking to you, dear people, and citizens on the far end of Alpha Centauri. On today's show, I talked to Eleanor Matthews, who was the fall 2018 resident of the Kerouac House here in Orlando, Florida. That is the city beautiful. So the Kerouac House is currently accepting applications for its residency program. I am a board member of the Kerouac House. I do not read for its selection committee. I recuse myself. I know too many people, but it is a great pleasure to get to talk to the people who do, in fact, become residents. So what's going on this week? Well, the Gillette Razor Company has made an ad suggesting that men should call out other men for toxic behavior. And really, I think this is probably a cynical move based on how many young men these days are opting for hipster beards by trying to equate moral decency with clean shavenness. That's just a guess. So earlier today, Saturday morning, I got to meet Jeff Curdy, the Disney historian who I interviewed, I think back on episode 16 of the show. He's one of the Disney luminaries that I've never actually met in person. Funny story, I bought a used copy of one of his books, Since the World Began, about Walt Disney World's first 25 years. And it was one of those books that kind of got me hooked on the whole Proustian bent of understanding and experiencing Walt Disney World on multiple levels, both in the present and in the past. And I bought the extra copy so he could autograph it, but I discovered after I got it home that he had already autographed it. But I brought it to him anyway, just to show off a little bit. And then he took a look at it, and he discovered that the preface that had been written by Roy O. Disney, that's Walt's nephew and one of the people responsible for the whole Disney renaissance of animated films, starting with The Little Mermaid, kind of starting before that, but culminating with The Little Mermaid. Anyway, he had autographed that copy too. So more history than I had anticipated when I paid $7 for a pretty great book. Anyway, Jeff Curdy was incredibly pleasant to talk to. He gave a wonderful presentation about his book, Travels with Walt Disney, which I actually couldn't buy a copy of because at Walt Disney World, they were sold out. So congratulations, Jeff, on that. Okay, let's get to the interview, in which Eleanor and I do not talk about Disney.
And now, the interview of the day.
Well, dear listeners, I am in the Drunken Odyssey's not-so-secret, not-headquarters, Jack Kerouac's house once again with its fall 2018. Were you the summer resident or the fall resident?
Fall resident.
Fall resident. It's usually just so hot that it's hard to tell when the season's beginning and end. Eleanor Matthews from Bristol, England. Mm-hmm. And you've been working on a novel while you're here?
I have indeed. I started at the beginning and now I'm about two-thirds of the way through, which is very exciting. It's been a really wonderful opportunity to have a bit of space and time to write.
Right. This is a pretty long residency.
Yeah. And no distractions apart from the builders next door.
There's a McMansion being built next to this historic site. So what has the residency been like for you?
Really amazing. And I think because the novel I'm trying to write is quite, I've tried to describe it as a quiet novel, I guess. It's set in a kind of one claustrophobic place. And it's very much about the sense of that place. Being able to have the headspace to really imagine that and kind of put myself there is really valuable. It's not Florida. it's from the kind of the places back in the UK. But in a way, the contrast also helps because you're not being distracted by reality because reality is too vivid to compare to the UK.
Well, and, you know, it probably helps you not take your environment in England for granted.
Yeah,
even in your memory.
Definitely. Yeah, something's become clearer with distance, I think. Both the kind of social aspects of it and the kind of actual landscape and flora and things like that, because it's certainly very different here. Things growing on things growing on things.
So how did you want to become a writer?
How did I know I wanted to become a writer?
Well, what was that process, that awakening or that sickness or whatever we want to call it?
So I have always written, not always fiction, but it's been the one thing I've always gone to in times of excitement or stress. And it's kind of been bubbling along in the background for a long time. And when I left university, I got fairly soon into a kind of a writing job. And I did that. I was working at the Red Cross as their international writer for a while. And that was great in some ways and very quite full on. But that didn't leave any capacity for creative writing. Or there was literally time in the day, but I didn't want to. So after about 2.5 years of working for them, I said to them, I need to go part-time because I want to try writing, which felt like a bit of a shot in the dark because at the time I wasn't really doing much. But I knew I needed to change something. And they said, well, this is a 24-hour job, which was very understandable. So I left.
You don't get to write your own job description. Thank you very much.
Exactly. So I left that job and found a part-time job and have been kind of working half kind of marketing writing and half fiction writing ever since.
And so the half is the secret to being able to...
Yes. Yes, and I'm very lucky to... I mean, I used to live in London. I moved out to Bristol to make that easier because London's very expensive. So. So I'm very lucky in that I'm able to work half, like 2.5 days a week, which is makes quite a big difference.
So I've taken a look at some of your manuscript called Where the Magpie Flies, which is a post-apocalyptic or no dystopian novel, right? Mm. I haven't gotten deep enough in to know what was the cause of so much dystopia. But one of the things that I find remarkable, and maybe this is an English quality, you can correct me if I'm being, you know, culturally reductionist or something, but you know, there's a wonderful tension as right, we're given two characters in two environments, one running away. And it's a very, you know, you described your other book as a quiet book. And there's a very balanced sensibility here in the storytelling. And yet it also feels like the dramatic tension is totally there, even though the sentences just feel really perfectly balanced. And the tone just seems matter of fact, even though characters could be murdered or they're looking at being threatened either by their government or by the forces that are going against the government. So to me, it seemed like maybe a quiet book by some of my American standards, and yet I also felt really gripped by it. So is that just a natural English sensibility or is that, you know, also your persona as a writer and your preferred style?
It's hard to kind of see oneself from the outside. I think my natural writing style does tend towards the kind of quiet, just even when loud things are happening, just because I think my writing is usually, the sense of place comes out a lot and it's less about dialogue and more about the kind of lonely characters within their surroundings, even if those surroundings are people. It's not really it's not really intentional, but I definitely
some of the dialogue
that
does seem lonely.
But in terms of it kind of being matter of fact in the face of all these terrible, the ongoing conflict, that was very intentional, because one of the seeds that kind of led me to write this was working at the Red Cross as the international writer, because I was working for a long time on the Syria appeal, raising funds for working in Syria. And I was kind of meeting people who were, some of them were people that were actually volunteering there, Syrians, and or I was just kind of editing pieces that were very about that situation at that time. And this isn't me transposing that conflict onto the UK and appropriating it in that way. But one of the things that really disturbed me at that point was that I'd been to Syria a few months before and the conflict broke out, just on holiday. And then I ended up kind of writing about it and still meeting people who were working out there. But there was this real dissonance between the way Syria was presented in the news and the place that I'd experienced very, very shortly prior to that. And of course, I was just a tourist, so it wasn't like I was getting the full insight into the culture. But
and some major changes were happening.
But it had shifted so quickly. And, you know, I went to Jordan when that conflict was already ongoing and people were still crossing the border. And I'm not at all saying that there wasn't a serious issue going on, but I found it disturbing the way, certainly in the UK, the media portrayed it as this other place and this conflict could only happen somewhere else. And I actually thought, that's not true. We could easily tip into some kind of horrible conflict, and I feel like it would happen without us noticing it.
What if Brexit's only the beginning?
Right, exactly. But I feel like because America's kind of got a similar...
What if Donald Trump is not the end of something horrible, exactly, but the beginning of something even more horrible?
Exactly, and I feel like because we've got not internationally, but quite a domestically stable history for the last how many years, it kind of leads to this complacency where you feel like, oh, but nothing like that could ever happen here. So if it's happening there, there's a sort of slight blame aspect to that, even though people think it's horrible that it's happening somewhere else.
Why did you let that happen to your country?
Exactly.
It would never happen to our country.
Yeah, right.
While...
Yeah, this was written pre-Brexit, so I didn't want to be proved right, but...
Well, I mean, in America, do we have to have the argument that Nazis are bad? Like,
really? Yeah. Yeah. But I'm sure it's all going to get better soon, right?
It might.
Yeah.
But it's not going to get casually, simply, easily better, if it gets better.
Yeah, no, it needs work and people engaging.
Well, and one of the things that I thought was interesting about the way that you imagined this dystopian devolution of England as a country is that while there is authoritarian impulses going on with, and I love how casually you... It's not even exposition, but you just, by choosing the perfect phrase for what some new draconian measure would be, you have a very deft hand at creating that world and the rules of the way that world is working in ways in which you don't have to stop. Oh, by the way, okay, so...
Thank you.
And I presume this happens in the future, which gets you away from trying to specify years, because then that gets really awkward. Like 20 years ago in the year 2028, and you're like, okay, what? It's just awkwardly confusing. So you quite wonderfully managed to just slip in these details that feel so perfect that I feel oriented, even though you haven't oriented me except out of anything other than cleverness. And the way the authoritarian order works is it's imperfect, so that people are trying to negotiate their way through this really fraught political situation, and they're trying to figure it out. And because the government's only caring about certain things, it's not simply a matter of big brothers everywhere, like I have no options. It's like, no, you have no good options, but you have options. And so just that amount of agency in your characters seems to just give so much air in what is a very problematic world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to give them agency because I guess I was kind of more interested in the idea of people being accidentally implicated in conflict. And therefore, I didn't want to kind of just be painting a picture of this is what the dystopia is, and here's some characters because I need some characters. I wanted it to be about the characters and what they were doing anyway before and after this kind of imposition on their lives happened, because I've never been through that situation, but using my best attempts to imagine it and having spoken to people in similar situations, I feel like you'd probably be surprised that it happened at all. And almost it would kind of, well, I guess like we're talking about kind of Brexit and Trump land, you sort of carry on with your everyday despite these things that are escalating alongside that.
Well, have you thought about how you have structurally added all of these elements and created the rules and the history of your setting? Or is it just that you're really clever and you can just pull all this stuff off?
No, I'm well,
like, is it something that you worked for a balance with, or is it something that kind of came naturally?
Well, it's been through a lot of drafts, this manuscript for one thing, and I'm a big believer in being open in the fact that most people need to do lots of drafts. Kerouac aside, sorry Kerouac.
Even he had more than one go.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm not an unbroken scroll kind of woman.
Well, but so. Those scrolls, he had like all these notes. So it's even if technically he didn't have that many drafts, he had all these notes. So it's not like, oh, just out of the pure muse and ether, all of this stuff poured out of him. I mean, yes, uppers helped, but also he did some planning. He did have a lot of the notes. So it wasn't just pure invention. So yeah, I think people, it's easy to exaggerate the romanticism of his approach. Like first version is always the best version.
Yeah, mine definitely wasn't. But I mean, in terms of the kind of how much background information to drop in where, I guess part of that's instinct in the same way as dropping other information in, but I definitely kind of adjusted the level of world building. I think my first earlier drafts had some of it, but less kind of fleshed out. And I went back in, you know, readers came back to me and said, I need more kind of sense of context earlier on. And, you know, so.
But they occasionally just go, what's happening?
Yeah, I think they knew what was happening. They just didn't know where.
Well, I know with my book, yeah, occasionally I would end up just, you know, I believe style and form and content should mirror each other in really interesting ways. And I'm writing a crazy book, which meant sometimes the style would just get so elaborate and messy that my readers would go, I got nothing after a certain point. And it's like, oh, okay. So if you take it back 20%, then it feels like amazing, but just a little bit past amazing is unbearable.
Yeah, and I mean, I find that a really difficult line to toe because I've tried to really strip it back because of the subject matter. I wanted it to be quite sparse, but then I've had people kind of read a bit of an old draft and then a new draft and be like, oh, but this bit's so much more descriptive, there's so much more there. And so I feel like it's always a balance, because if you lose some of the description, you gain pace, but, you know, vice versa.
Revision is unbearable in that way.
Yeah, it's difficult because you're always going to lose something if you're... Yeah.
So what was your education like? Where did you go to school?
How far back are we talking?
As far back as you want to go.
Well, I'll give you the full rundown, because I went to a very, very tiny primary school, which is kind of unusual in that there are only 30 people from age of 4 to age of 11. There's like 30 people in this tiny, tiny primary school. It was in the village over from mine. So I was there for that portion. And then I was at like a government school, a comprehensive school for the rest of my education. And then I went to university in Bristol. I did leave Bristol in the middle. I just kind of got drawn back after 5 years in London. So yeah, I went to... did English at University of Bristol.
And what was your writing instruction like?
We didn't get any. I think it would be a great... I think they've changed the syllabus a lot now. But at the time, it was very traditional. So it was much more focused on kind of working your way through the canon.
So reading more than writing.
Yeah, there wasn't a creative writing aspect at all, which was clear from the prospectus. But at the age of... whenever you choose 16, 17, I was making decisions based on which city I wanted to live in rather than kind of, so that was, you know, my fault for not reading the small print.
Oh, I don't know. I think there's a lot to be said for heading to where, you know, you want to live.
Yeah. And that kind of informed a lot of other things in my life. And
well, you know, the piece of advice every writing teacher in America gives, like, okay, what's the one piece of writing advice? Like, read more, just keep reading more.
Yeah. And I would 100%
get on board with that. I suppose the only thing is I find it quite difficult to read while I'm writing. I haven't read much in the house at all, even though there's these huge bookshelves but sort of looking at me like, use me. I find it quite difficult. I sometimes read poetry or nonfiction, but I find it hard to read other fiction unless it's more from a different era, because I worry that it will kind of creep in and influence my own writing too much.
Yeah, that's why I like... Well, actually, I'm almost never writing these days, which I guess means I'm pretty much free to read anything. But I do love reading poetry, especially when I'm not writing poetry. And yeah, I feel, I don't know, like I'm in a safe mental space reading poetry, whereas... Yeah, it took me at least a year and a half to get James Joyce out of my system after reading Ulysses.
Yeah, I feel like if someone's got a really compelling narrative voice, it's very difficult to then sit down the next day or whenever you're the next hour and switch back to your own. Sometimes that's good. I did read a book while I was here. I read The Sound and the Fury, but I figured that was from so far, well, not so far in the past, but long enough in the past that that's not a voice that's going to come naturally to me, past and geographically distant. So it felt safe.
Well, but if you haven't been reading, then I don't know if you're ready to pass the Jack Kerouac, you know, reading test that happens at the end of the residency.
At the end.
Yeah.
I've just got some notes written on my hand, so it should be fine.
Well, what writers inspired you and influenced you back when that was acceptable? Mm. Back when you were a wee thing.
It's a wee thing. Oh, that's such a difficult question. Might have to take a...
What's the Drunken Odyssey? You're allowed to give a sloppy, careless answer.
I don't know. There's so many. I went through a phase of really loving Fitzgerald, just the writing style and kind of the way with words that he has. But I wouldn't say that was my favorite in terms of content. I went through a phase of really loving Virginia Woolf, because that's kind of obligatory as a young woman in the UK.
Well, I went through a Woolf phase. Technically, I'm not really out of it.
Yeah, I think in terms of actually writing myself, though, it was, which sounds strange, but it was only kind of, I guess, after university and a little bit of time had passed, after I'd finished working through the canon, that I had the kind of free time to read things that were coming out, contemporary things. That was when I first thought, oh, I could do this. You know, not I'm immediately going to be as good as this, but I think up until that point, I just thought,
oh, there are people who aren't dead who are doing this.
Which sounds so obvious now I say it in retrospect, but it really was a bit of a revelation when I sort of read a book by a young British female author and thought, oh yeah, like that sounds like the voice in my head on paper. Okay, you know, obviously refined a lot, but that could work.
So who are some of those writers?
I think I can actually tell you the book. It was by Evie Wilde called, I think it's called After the Fire, A Small Still Voice. Quite a one to remember. But yeah, I loved it, but it was also kind of something that, not that I would be able to recreate or saying that I'm as good a writer as her, but yeah, I could imagine writing something, reading that.
I'm trying to remember when I started, like even when I was reading contemporary writers for a while, though, I was still only reading like the pinnacle, like people who are already in the canon, like Toni Morrison and Thomas Pynchon.
Well, this is what I mean. It took a few years after university because I was so sort of stuck in that mindset of I must only read the greatest literature because there's so much of it and I won't even read it all before I die. So I can't possibly read anything that's not in that canon. And yeah, getting outside of that was really... Oh, Jenny Fagan as well. I read a book by her called The Panopticon, which is, again, it's inspiring in that it's someone writing something I recognize.
Well, for me, it was, and I realize this sounds predictable as all hell, but yeah, for me, it was David Foster Wallace, where it's like, oh, he's like this full of fireworks, but conversational. And yeah, he kind of sounds like my head sometimes. And so I think, yeah, I went through a minor phase of imitation of him, but I think he taught me that I could find a way to bridge between the sort of very academic and abstract and very convoluted way of looking at things and presenting it in a way that's a lot more conversational and lived in and human.
Yeah, I think it's really valuable to find the people that write in a way that you can imagine writing. I grew up reading a lot of kind of Victorian novels. I wasn't really allowed to watch TV very much, and we had a lot of kind of very old books. And so reading that kind of literature is obviously broadens your mind in some ways. And if you read my childhood diaries, I did write a little bit like I was a Victorian. It's quite odd, but that's not, you know...
Which Victorians?
Dickens or...
Yeah, which doorstops did you read?
The ones I remember reading...
Dickens, Trollope, yeah. Thackeray, maybe?
Yeah, mainly Dickens, actually. We had a lot of Dickenses, and also, well, this isn't Victorian, but we had kind of Gormenghast and those. This was like when I was in primary school, and I just remember reading these things and not quite understanding the words, but not really understanding the concepts at age 10. Going, why has she jumped off a cliff? Why would anyone do that? I don't understand.
Because she was in a book. Yeah. So how did you find out about the residency?
So many people have asked me this, and I feel like I need to make up an answer because I found it on the internet.
You drink so much you don't remember.
Yeah, yeah, right. Like every true writer. No, I actually don't remember. It was somewhere on the internet, and it appealed because it's such a chunk of time, because I do still have a job in the UK. I needed something concrete to make it worthwhile taking a break from that, and especially if you're traveling a long way. So yeah, no, it's...
Well, have you done other residencies?
No, this is my first.
This is your first. Well, now you're going to be spoiled.
Yeah, I know. I feel like...
Yeah. Most residencies, yeah, they're not nearly this long. Plus, there are other people there.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other people here. I'm proof of that. But, you know, like, you really don't have to put up with anybody if you don't want to.
No, if you're into solitude, this is wonderful. And I, from a writing point of view, I have loved that aspect. I am slightly too sociable to be... I hear that some residents just stay inside by themselves all the time. I'm slightly too sociable to do that. But, yeah, a day of silent writing and then a cycle ride around Orlando and chatting to whoever you meet.
Yes, you're crazy on that bicycle.
I love it. It's so exciting to me. All of the things which I think people here probably take for granted and think I'm very odd when I'm just there staring at the tree outside their house because it's full of cheese plants. Yeah, it's really exciting.
Well, this tree?
Oh, no, not this one. This one's also amazing. But I don't know how to say it. Lots of the plants here, you'd only ever see them as house plants in the UK. So I go around going, oh, there's one. But it's 12 times the size of a normal whatever.
Well, I do remember, you know, I was in the Midwest for my PhD, north central Indiana, mm-hmm. where there's like 5 months of winter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's... very few places like Florida. I mean, I'm sure there are places in South America that are probably wilder, but I remember I gave a paper at a James Joyce conference at the University of Miami, and I got my lunch. It was like, yeah, in the wintertime, and I got my lunch outside, and it was by the pool, and I could smell the coconut oil that people had put on as sunscreen. And I look up in a palm tree, and there are wild parrots. And I thought, I'm so glad I'm here.
I've had a lot of moments like that. Just that there's some really excellent geckos and lizards on the porch of the Kerouac House. There's one that's kind of velvety black with a... I mean, if anyone that's listening to this lives in Florida, they're going to be like, and? What's your point? But it's really beautiful. It's got kind of...
Yeah, we have oxygen here too.
A red pouch that comes out of its neck. It's really exciting.
So, pretty long residency. And do you feel like you've gotten enough work done, or do you feel like ashamed of yourself and disgraced because, you know, the...
No, I feel quite happy with the amount I've done. I seem unable to write more than 1,000 words a day. That's just how I work. And I've done that most of the days I've intended to, with some thinking space in between. So yeah, I feel pretty good about it. I did have a kind of wild ambition of, oh, I'm going to finish the whole draft while I'm out here. But that would have meant I had to do that every single day, which was, to start with, I was like, I am going to manage it. But it quickly became obvious that wasn't true, just because I wanted to make the most of meeting the people from the community out here as well, rather than just...
We're so charming.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It does help you live with yourself if you could just go, all right, I got a lot of work done. I'll feel good about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've put myself under crazy pressure to do deadlines before, and it works, but it is kind of soul destroying. So I feel like for the longevity of my writing, it's probably better if I can write an amount I'm pleased with and then go outside and see people and kind of have a balance.
And so what do you think of the Orlando literary scene?
It's amazing. I I know that everyone says this, but I had no idea. yeah, it's kind of...
Well, from the outside, yeah, it's hard to see.
yeah, it feels really vibrant, though. And not only is everyone extremely friendly, but the kind of level of things being produced and, you know, just nights I've been to where people have been reading, it's such kind of good stuff going on here.
Well, you've seen a functionally literate. You've seen a crazy music poetry show.
I have.
You read at Loose Lips.
Yeah, I did. That was
our monthly trauma bonding over the news in a literary form.
Mm-hmm. That was great. I'm so impressed. As a slow writer, I was very impressed by people that had whipped something up in the 30-day news cycle.
Well, normally people just vent their anger.
You know, I'm impressed by that too.
My spleen has to have someplace to go. Which reminds me, oh shit, I'm doing it next month, so I should probably think of something. Yeah, maybe I could just drunkenly talk about my... No, I probably need like a real topic. I should probably be act like a real writer. Well, you know, I think I've done three of those Loose Lips readings, and at least one of them, like, I got published. So sometimes, and the others I think could have, but I just don't have the energy to try and find a home for it. But one, like, I knew the perfect home for it. And I think that's true of, like, a lot of what gets written is, like, no, a lot of it stands out.
Yeah, and...
Though it is mostly an excuse to just drink with your friends.
I feel like for the last one, the drinking was needed, right? Given the election results were live streaming.
Yeah. And then the news looked like it might get better, and then it turns out, well, after a long delay, no, the news wasn't really any better.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. Doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
Hi, this is John Waters, and you're listening to The Drunken Odyssey. Keep on listening, or I'll have you killed.
So you've written a novel, you're working on another novel, you write short stories. So what's the difference between a short story and a novel other than, say, 90,000 words?
I find short stories very rewarding but tricky because of the plot. I find getting a short story that kind of is satisfying is, like, some people seem to have a knack for it. It takes me a lot of work.
Well, a short story is playing a song on a vinyl record, and you have to drop the needle in at exactly the right point.
Oh, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
And I'm a clumsy person, so, like, with very big fingers, and I was like, zzz, and it's like, oh.
Yeah, I feel like I kind of have to play the whole record, and then I don't know how to extend that metaphor, but then scratch it with a needle. I don't know.
Play the whole record, yeah, tape it, and then take the tape. And
yeah,
then,
yeah, exactly. Also, I like that with short stories, they're more collaborative in terms of you write something, you can share it with people, they give you feedback, or, you know, if you're lucky enough to have people you can do that with, you can let it out into the world and play with it a bit sooner, and that's kind of rewarding.
A lot sooner, unless you're Joyce Carol Oates.
Yeah, a lot sooner. And there is something glorious about working on a project that no one has any knowledge of for a year or two before having to show it to anyone.
My but secret it's project.
Very nerve-wracking. But on the flip side, I think my brain does work in a long-form way more naturally.
Do you feel like there's a tension between characterization and the story you have in mind?
How do you mean? Sorry.
Well, when I write a story, I think all of my characters seem bewildered that things are moving forward, you know, when they're kind of doing their best to be comic foils to whatever it is that's happening around them.
Yeah. I guess I don't feel there's a tension in that respect.
Are you allowed to say, you know, that's a stupid question?
No, I think I'm trying to imagine how it would play out. I feel like the characters are usually resistant to whatever's happening to them, but that's okay. And it kind of doesn't, because the events are often external or they're, you know, things going on within them that they don't have control over. It's not necessarily a rub between those two things.
I think partly why I was asking that is because in a novel, right, finding an equilibrium between, okay, like the characters, like there's this action and of course you have to have things happen and cause and effect. And you can kind of choose, okay, well, if I have all of this space, like I'm drawing in the air with my pen as if that's going to work on a podcast. You have all of the space to work in so that you can figure out, okay, like here's going to be a conversation where we learn more about this person because it's appropriate. And, you know, like, oh, she's walking her bike this way. And so she has time to reflect a little bit where there's going to be times when she just doesn't want to get shot or arrested, where not much introspection at moments like that. Whereas in a short story, you have to pick, I mean, partly you have to pick the exact right moment, but also the exact right situation so that you can somehow get enough characterization in there and you don't, it's not like you can make up the time later.
Yeah, okay, I see what you mean. Yes, I do find it difficult because I feel maybe because most of my reading when I was younger was novels and long form stuff. I think my brain does work.
Victorian.
I think my brain does work more in that way.
There should be like there should be a different word for novel the way Victorians do it, like a super novel or something.
The fireside novel, the fireside tome. Yes, I do think so. Because
like Oliver Twist is a novel, but, you know, like Dickens wrote more than like Little Dorrit's a super novel.
Yeah, I think I tend to write too much of the character, which is unnecessary. It may be necessary for my knowledge of it, but then I have to do a lot of cutting to make it into a story. And sometimes I find that I haven't made a story. I've just done a character scene. So yeah, I think that's one of the reasons probably I find short stories tricky. And the plotting aspect of short stories tricky is because I want to put everything about the character in there and there just isn't room. But also it's kind of a fun game trying to make that work.
As long as you're patient with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fun game that I come back to when I when I feel like it.
So you are having a hard time sleeping in the house?
Yeah, I am.
Jack's ghost is humming along. And
yeah, kind of. I don't believe in ghosts, but I do get...
You can hear some drunken haikus and coming from...
Do you get quite freaked out in this house for some reason that I can't quite put my finger on? But it's difficult to say that whether that's just because people have insisted on telling me ghost stories and I'm quite susceptible to getting scared.
Well, it's a quiet neighborhood so that if you don't have music on or, you know, just generating some noise. Yeah, and it's... Okay, actually, I don't know if this counts as old for you in terms of being an old house, but...
By Florida
standards, this seems like quite old.
I don't want to cast aspersions on the age of the house, but it's not particularly old by English standards, but it is a very beautiful house. Yeah, I live in a flat in the UK that's probably older than this, but it doesn't bother me. I think it might be something to do with the sort of detached neighborhood, the detached house in a quiet neighborhood. And also...
And that gaslit construction next door.
Yeah. Sometimes they leave random lights on in the house next door just to sort of add to the eerie impression.
That's where the killer is up there doing work.
Right.
That's not to look too into it too much.
It sounds like a strange point as well, but I think it might be something to do with in America, you don't get pedestrians, or not in America in general. In this part of America, you don't seem to get as many pedestrians at night because everyone drives. So in my mind, I'm like, oh, there's probably loads of people going past looking in the windows, but there's probably no one walking past because it's night.
Maybe one person an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're not really looking.
No, exactly. So yeah, I think it's just getting used to it. Either that or it is the spirit of Jack. I mean, I haven't sat in his chair.
What?
No, it's kind of... I mean, I know it's been professionally cleaned 3 times, but it...
Oh, it's very clean. And it's very comfortable.
Is it?
It is.
I don't know.
superstitious about it. I'm not superstitious, but I feel superstitious about it.
Well, I think you are superstitious about it because it does look ratty. I will grant you that. But it's unreasonably comfortable. It doesn't look like it's going to be especially comfortable at all. It just looks like somebody should have thrown it out 40 years ago.
Maybe on my last day here, I'll read in the chair for a few hours. And then if I just disturb the spirits, it won't matter.
I seem to think, yeah, that would make a good podcast experiment. So there was that night after Functionally Literate where you were riding everywhere on your bike. So, I mean, are you a bike rider? Like, because it seemed like you were just casually just going far with the bike to me.
Yeah, I mean, I've always cycled a lot. I guess it's the best mode of transport in a lot of UK cities. Well, in my opinion, I used to cycle. I didn't drive either until a couple of years ago. So when I lived in London, I cycled everywhere. And that's quite a long way to cycle sometimes. So yeah, I feel the distances in Orlando don't bother me that much. I mean, I haven't been to outer Orlando, but I don't even know what there is there. I'm sure lots of lovely things.
Just more Orlando.
Okay. Yeah. But for me, it feels like quite an easy way to get around the city. And also there's no pedestrians, so I can just ride on the pavements. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do that, but no one seems to mind.
Yeah, I think it's legally not preferred, but I'm not sure exactly what the law is about that. Well, I know that for me, walking is a really important part of my riding process or thinking process. And that if I don't go for a walk at least once a week, like I just, all right, why am I so pissed off? What's what? And it's like, oh, because I just, my body and my mind kind of need to sync up at some point. And yeah, simply eating, driving, grading, lecturing, like, okay, like where? So is cycling like that for you?
Yeah, definitely. And I think more so here than it is in the UK, because in the UK, the roads are, well, where I live, the roads are a lot smaller and busier, and there's a lot more to pay attention to.
Dirtier?
Yeah, dirtier as well. It's true. Whereas here, you can kind of, and also this, the bike here is very sort of, it's got a big cushiony seat and you kind of sat back in it. So you feel like you're cruising. And so I think it's kind of similar to walking in that respect, that you're kind of doing a repetitive motion with your body that's unwinding something in your mind, and while you're not consciously solving plot problems, that sort of back brain is maybe doing that, or it's just relaxing, one of the two.
Or it's settling you down so that your brain can get to it eventually. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, so I mean, I mean, it's kind of like massaging the brain.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, it may take me 4 or 5 times to even get an idea close to clear, you know, so that's like, okay, you've got a botched epiphany and then a botched epiphany, and then it's like, oh, no, that's it. That's okay. Now it makes sense. Because Noam Chomsky and other linguists have the theory that our capacity for speech is hardwired, that it's something that we don't create. It's something that we discover in ourselves, and that there are different variations, right, between like what language you happen to grow up learning and being surrounded with. And I think, and this is just a casual metaphor, I'm not trying to pretend there's a scientific argument to be made here, but the things that I respond to in the way that you can explain the world that your characters in Where the Magpie Flies live in, just very casually, of course it's not casual, but it feels very casual because you have these authenticating details for this world that doesn't exist, with these perfect sounding laws and political phenomena that feel like they're real, and you just are mentioning these real things when in fact you're making them up. And that's how I feel about some of my best writing. Is, you know, maybe one word for it is clever, but it feels like, okay, no, they're real now. Like they've been waiting for me to just go, oh, right, that's what it is. You know, it's a difference between a mediocre song and like a classic song. And like, sometimes you just hear a brand new classic song and you're like, it feels like that song has always been here. And I've just been waiting to recognize it.
Yeah, I definitely feel like sometimes, especially when I was first starting out seriously writing, where I would get derailed was where I was too in love with my own writing and kind of the idea of writing, and I wasn't actually writing about something that I'd bothered to imagine already. Or let me rephrase that, because I think I do my imagining as I write, but there does still need to be a whole room, a whole person, a whole world, and you're kind of choosing which way to illuminate it, rather than
Well, and if you race Duplant, then, you know, sometimes these things don't flower the way they need to or find their ideal form.
Yeah, definitely.
And so it seems to me like, yeah, a 3-month residency might be a really great opportunity. And so the bike riding probably just, you know, keeps that engine running smooth.
Yeah, definitely. I think I would maybe have gone mad if I hadn't have done the bike riding. I don't want a shining situation here.
So where have you been riding? And, you know, what are some of the things that you've seen? Because partly it's, okay, yeah, you're just, all right, you're working the body and are you increasing the oxygen content and what's going to your brain? And, you know, there's the health thing, but there's also the, right, getting out of this house, wonderful house, but you got to get out of the house and, you know, explore the world a little bit. So, like, do you have any stories about?
There are things, again, that are probably exceptional to me, but maybe not if you live in Orlando. I found a...
Well, this podcast goes out all over the world, okay. So...
Well, I found an area of Orlando where there just, for unexplained reasons, seemed to be a lot of peacocks just roaming the streets. And there were also signs about the peacocks crossing the roads.
Respect the peacocks.
I have no idea what that was about, but I enjoyed it. And, you know, Orlando's great for cycling because it's got these huge lakes everywhere that you can just kind of cruise around. I mean, you could go round and round and round if you really wanted to condition your brain back into working order.
If you have some OCD things that you need to kind of grind through.
Yeah. The most exceptional thing that's happened to me when I was cycling was early in my residency when it was still really, really stormy, getting caught out in a huge Florida thunderstorm and kind of thinking, will the rubber of these handlebars counteract the metal of the frame? Probably not.
Not if it comes down to it.
Trying to cycle away from this thunderstorm and getting absolutely drenched, more so than I've ever been in my life. But I'm very short-sighted and I can only see maybe 5 inches from my eyes without contact lenses. And I was cycling with contact lenses in and they started washing out of my eyes so I couldn't see. And I had to pull over by the side of the road and blink heavily for about a minute until I could see again, kind of shielding my eyes with my hands. And that was quite exciting.
And so that's a moment of vulnerability you can give a character somewhere down the line.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the weather here is incredible. Like the sheet lightning as well. Sheet lightning, is that what you call it? Where it kind of the sky flashes with lightning? Or heat lightning?
We just call it summer.
Okay. Summer is amazing. I love your flashing skies.
Yeah, no, we have some serious weather here. Mm-hmm. Not in the wintertime, but so now that the weather's perfect, you have to leave.
Yeah, right. I'm going to have a week of perfect weather and then off. Off to the maybe not so perfect weather in the UK.
Pretty cold there.
I hear so.
Foggy.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and I'm going straight to the north. not the north in the dystopian sense, but the real north. So that will be cold.
So the new novel is not dystopian.
No, it's not dystopian.
Limited setting.
Limited setting. It does, I guess it's interested. I'm interested in the same kind of social class politics aspect, which is inherently a bit dystopian, but it's not set in the future. It's
set in the horrors of the present.
In the horrors of the present. Yeah, exactly.
So do you feel like the limited setting, is that what the story demanded out of you? Or is that you going, all right, let's make this fun. What rules am I going to impose on myself?
A bit of both. I feel like I find structure really useful and I don't want it to be, this time I'm trying to write without a set idea of where the plot is going because I want it to be led by the characters, which feels like a very scary thing to be doing, but it's quite fun because it's like reading very slowly in that I only find out what's going to happen at the same pace as a reader would. But even though that aspect I'm kind of trying to be more loose with, I tend to write in a very structured way of, okay, so this character is going to speak for this many words and then this character is going to come in for this many words. And I find that really useful. And that might change in future edits, but I find that a very useful way of kind of giving myself a sense of where things are going. And so I suppose having the limited setting is partly that, but it's also that I really wanted the kind of premise of the book, it's really important that the reader buys into that setting and both in a kind of feeling attached to it way and feeling the claustrophobia of it. And I don't want to give too much away because it's not finished yet, but that's important to the plot as well. So kind of a bit of both.
I suppose if it is a restriction just for the hell of it, it's probably a bad idea.
I don't know. Some writers seem to really flourish under restriction just for the hell of it.
Maybe. Well, there's what George Perec, who has a void, a novel called A Void, which doesn't have the letter E in it, which in French is even scarier than in English. But
also, you know, is it Eleanor Catton, the luminaries that won the Booker Prize? That was very, as I understand it, very rigidly structured, both in the shortening lengths of the chapters, I think, and being related to an ancient star chart, which determined where all the characters went.
And the trick is to make it seem like it isn't a gimmick.
Yeah, right. So obviously you've got to make the rest of it convincing, otherwise it will feel probably quite irritating.
Yeah, so maybe you have to be French. Mm. Either that or, you know, just especially perverse, like to just be so in love with the restriction and then to be able to squeeze a meaningful, good story out of that.
Although I think it's, I mean, playing the devil's advocate, I think it's interesting that the idea of restriction doesn't come into prose very much, given it's so prevalent in kind of poetry and other forms of writing.
Novels being encouraged to be loose and baggy monsters and whatnot.
Yeah, and lots of other art forms do have restrictions, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, what restriction did Charles Dickens put upon himself? Write more. That was his restriction.
Well, paid by the word. I guess a lot of it was serialized, right? So it was maybe, this is the deadline. How much can you write by this deadline to get out in this week's, I don't know, paper?
Write more, write faster.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give for a young writer?
I suppose rolling off what we've been talking about today, reading a lot, but also a great variety of things, including things where you might see yourself or your voice represented. Not that that's the only way to get fulfillment out of a book, but it's just, I feel like it's really encouraging and kind of gives you an idea of where you could go personally.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Eleanor Matthews. Don't forget to check out The Drunken Odyssey throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth. If you'd like to write in to me, please do. Lauren, remind people how, please.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Thank you, Lauren. Okay, gang, until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life, is a supernova, an interstellar jamboree of colors and lights, like the twirling dresses of a troupe of champion folk dancers, like being imprisoned inside Ace Frehley's amp, throbbing like the veins in Jehovah's hard-on. You can look, but you can't touch, and also you can't look, because if you do, you will turn to stone, and your guts will turn to marble.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. And I think, truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.